on the screen, but you might want it up as well. Back in my talk on Job chapter 6 and 7, I said that we were leaving the path. Remember that illustration? Up until that point, the book was quite straightforward. Job, we saw in chapters 1 and 2 about discussion between God and the accuser in heaven in the background, and then these trials and troubles that came upon poor Job, even though he was a good man, a very good man, and a godly man, and yet a rich man, and he lost all of that prosperity, and lost his children, and yet refused to curse God, refused to curse God, and so the accuser's cynicism was refuted, and yet that wasn't the end, that was just the beginning. Job poured out his heart, feeling desperate and hopeless, and then his friends who had arrived to comfort him. The first friend we saw, Eliphaz, in chapters 4 and 5, we saw that he was convinced that there must be a reason for this. Job must have done something wrong, and that Job, though he was a good man, needed to repent of whatever it was, and then things would be put right. And so that was quite straightforward, those opening chapters 1 to 5. But from then on, you enter this thick jungle of arguments, going back and forth. First one of the comforters speaks, and Job replies, and then the next, Job replies, and so on. A whole cycle of three comforters, and then another cycle begins. And suffering and trouble can be like that. Relentless, going on and on, seemingly unending, going round and round in circles. Well, last week we reached the end of chapter 19, and we're truly in the thick of it. 16 chapters into the debate, and there are 20 more before God finally speaks. And last time we saw some beams of light, so a bit of a breakthrough that Job had made, and yet we're not out of the woods yet by any stretch. The big challenge in this book of Job, and I guess for those of you who have read the book of Job yourself individually will have already felt this, is to try and see how the argument is moving forward. You sort of get lost in the round and round, and you sort of think, what's going on? Well, the bit that we've reached today may look similar to bits we've already been through, but it's not. It's further along the path, and the scenery is changing, even though there are some things which are repeated and very familiar. And what we need to do is to sort of spot the difference. Get to know what spot the difference is. You've got two pictures and you say, what's the same, but then what's different? So what we're going to do is, today we're looking at four chapters. We're looking at chapters 20 and 21, and then 23 and 24. This is chapter 22, we'll come back to that next week. But we're looking at chapters 20 and 21, 23 and 24. And we'll find that two of those chapters are very similar to what we've had before. And yet two of the chapters are introducing new things, taking us forward. And we're going to look at all four of them. The similar ones are similar because they've got lessons that we need to hear again, or something that we need to learn from again. And then we're going to see how the argument's moving on, how things are developing. So I'm going to start with, so we're asking what's the same and what's new. We're going to start with chapter 20, and I've called that The Pounding Continues. The Pounding Continues. Now, we don't need to spend long on chapter 20 because we've heard it all before. This is Zophar's second speech. Three comforters, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Eliphaz and Bildad have spoken, and then Zophar spoken, and then we round again on the second round. This is his second speech. We can sum it up in some words from chapter 20 and verse 5, the second half of verse 5. The joy of the godless is but for a moment. Momentary. The joy of the godless is momentary. Now they're joyful for a bit, but then trouble comes. Now, last time we looked at the second speeches of Eliphaz and Bildad, but really all these three speeches in cycle 2 are pretty much the same. Each starts with a blunt criticism, and then fairly quickly, each one moves on to a long description of the fate of the wicked man. Now, Zophar's contribution, his tone is a bit more aloof than the previous. His previous contributions a little bit less heated than Eliphaz and Bildad in cycle two. He's taking the moral high ground, but it soon turns pretty nasty. Do you not know this from of old, that the exalting of the wicked is short? I'm putting up there, some verses that capture the main, I've sort of distilled the chapter, put them up on there. That's the basic point. Do you not know this from of old, that the exalting of the wicked is short? Job's breakthrough hasn't silenced Zophar. If anything, the friends are even more determined to get Job to own up to whatever secret sin that he's hiding, or that they assume that he's hiding. And then the next verses just unpack verse 5 with their usual description. Though his head reached to the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, yet his food is turned in his stomach. He swallows down riches and vomits them up again. The main idea is this change of fortunes. Once high, he's going to perish and vanish. His health will decay. He savored evil morsels. They went down, but now he's bringing them up again. And then there's the usual description of judgments, tailored to make it clear that we know who is being suggested. The hand of everyone in misery will come against him. God will send his burning anger against him. A bronze arrow will strike him through. A fire not fanned will devour him. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The possessions of his house will be carried away, dragged off in the day of God's wrath. This is the fate of the evil man. Of course, it's very closely fits what's happened to Job. That's the point that they're making. Poverty will overtake him. Prosperity won't last. The people who he's afflicted will attack him. God will fill his belly with burning anger. God will pierce him through. Everything he owns will be consumed. Heaven will expose him and earth will oppose him. The usual stuff. And in the middle is a veiled accusation as to what Job's supposed crimes are. For he has crushed and abandoned the poor. He seized a house that he did not build. There was nothing left after he had eaten oppression and greed, taking everything, leaving nothing for others. There's absolutely not a shred of evidence that Job has done this. It's not like us looking at someone who has a lot of money and assuming that that person must have cheated to get it or been dishonest, or see someone driving past in a nice car and say they must have nicked that. There's no evidence at all that Job is like this, but they're starting, their imagination is, there's no evidence, and so they're filling in the gaps with these ideas. Verse 29 sums it up. This is the wicked man's portion from God. More of the same than these counts. There's comfort. It's on and on. We've abridged the chapter, but even the chapters are maybe a summary of the whole debate. We feel that it's going on, but it may have been longer than that. In chapter 23, verse 2, Job says, "Today also my complaint is bitter." Perhaps the debate has raged on for days. Maybe there's been this and that, back and forth. Maybe it's just captured for us in the poetry of the book of Job. The pounding continues. So what do we learn? We learn about the persistence of the enemy. This is the enemy's doing. So we saw the pounding that Job had in chapter 1 and then in chapter 2 with his health. But now through these unwitting servants of the adversary, they're not there doing his business, but they are doing his business. The pounding is continued. Job is gaining ground, but Satan is just not giving up. We read in Revelation 12, the next chapter we'll get to. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. Seen Job has had this breakthrough, but the pounding is continuing. We see again the on and onness of trial. We saw it back in chapter 3, and it's a good time to remember it again. 20 weary chapters, and we're not halfway through yet. Ill health, opposition, unemployment, temptation, bereavements, depression, whatever it is, whatever trials people suffer and struggle, there's often an on and onness. It's not just the moment, but it's the ongoingness which is so difficult. So we're reminded that we should pray on for brothers and sisters in the midst of trial. To pray on for them, there may be no let up for them in the pressure And so let us not grow weary in upholding them. You know, when a crisis comes, it's very easy to respond in prayer, isn't it? You call a prayer meeting or it's the news and then you pray. And yet you need to keep on praying. Keep on praying for people who've lost loved ones. Keep on praying for people who've got chronic ill health. Keep on praying for those who've lost their job and haven't found one yet. Keep on praying for people whose family situation is difficult, whatever it might be. We're not in their situation. That's why we forget. But because we're not in their situation, that's why we should remember. See, we should pray for them and then be resolved to persevere with God's help. Be resolved to persevere. Say, when trouble comes, it may go on and on. God has warned us of that. Be resolved to persevere. Whatever the devil throws at you, whatever life throws at you, we need God's sustaining grace. How we need his grace. Only he can keep us from falling. Only he can present us faultless. So that's chapter 20. We're going to come back to 21. And as I said, we're skipping 22 this week and look at it next time, God willing. But, so let's jump forward now to chapter 23, because that further illustrates Job's ongoing trial. This is more of the same. And this is more of the same. The wavering continues. The wavering continues. Remember, Job's faith is like the tide. I said that last time, didn't I? The ebb and the flow. It's coming in, it's going out, it's coming in, it's going out. The great insight at the end of chapter 19 has not washed Job up onto some secure rock, unseen and untroubled. It's not as if he's got out now and everything's easy. Not like that. He's had a breakthrough of understanding. I know that my Redeemer lives. And yet he's still in the midst. He's still in it. That's how it often is. He's still swinging back and forth between hope and frustration. Let me show you that in the chapter. First, it's negative. Today also, my complaint is bitter. Oh, that I knew where I might find him. But then it's a bit more positive. I would lay my case before him. I would understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would pay attention to me. There an upright man could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge. It's positive. Then it's negative, verse 9, but when he is working, I do not see him. If I could find him, all would be well, but I can't. But then it's positive again, but he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come out as gold. I have kept his way and have not turned aside. And then it's negative again, but he is unchangeable, and who can turn him back? What he desires, that he does. Therefore, I am terrified at his presence. God has made my heart faint, yet I'm not silenced because of the darkness. Do you see that in the chapter? One moment there's hope, and then there's despair, and then there's hope, and there's despair. That's why it's so hard to read the book of Job, because you sort of think, well, what's he saying in chapter 23? And the answer is, what he's saying in chapter 23 is this, and this, and this, and this. It's easy with the comforter. Sometimes you get your arms around them, you can say, well, this is what they're saying. They're consistent. They're on message. But for Job, the wavering continues. One moment confidence and hope, the next moment uncertainty and despair. So I've summed it up there. Oh, that I might find him, but I'm terrified at his presence. Tried to sum up the chapter. Oh, that I might find him, but I am terrified at his presence. The wavering continued. I wonder if you've ever been through this. Maybe you're there now. Maybe there's someone there now. You seem to get a victory. You're enabled to trust in God. And then suddenly you're anxious again. Trusting, you're anxious, committed it to God. And then suddenly it's going around in your head again. You're embittered, but then you've been enabled to forgive. But then you wake up with the same bitterness in your soul, and then you try and forgive, and you're struggling, and or whatever it might be. Optimism, pessimism, up, down, the wavering continued. Have you ever been through this? And this is not abnormal, not for a Christian under pressure. Abnormal if that would be how it would be always for us. And yet some people struggle like that anyway. But when we're under pressure, and often we are under pressure in one way or another, we're under pressure in our society as believers. It's not abnormal. There's a difference between winning a battle and winning the war. Job won the battle in chapter 19. But the war is not over yet. And as I say, each time, Job disabuses us of this false notion that somehow spiritual Christians float above it all. That's quite deep rooted in some traditions and some teachings. And we need to, there's a whole book of Job to disabuse us of that. Christians, spiritual Christians, do not float above it all. Sometimes they struggle. They may do in fictional novels or unhelpful biographies, but not in scripture, not in real life. Job is winning because he's still struggling. Struggle may not be a bad sign. In this case, it's not a bad sign. It's a sign of life. If he wasn't struggling, it would have been because there was no life. But he's struggling because he's still alive. Dead people don't struggle to trust God. Dead people don't struggle to trust God. Job is struggling to trust God because he's alive. The wavering continues. And yet there's definite progress, isn't there? Verses 6 and 7. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would pay attention to me. There an upright man could argue with him. I will be acquitted forever by my judge. That's a long way from the hopelessness of chapter 9, verses 10 and 11. He knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come out as gold. I've kept his way and I've not turned aside. That's definite progress from where all he wanted was to die. He is moving forward. It's an encouragement to us not to despair. We feel that we go back and forth sometimes, but we should persevere. But these chapters have not really moved the argument forward. This is more of the same, isn't it? Spot the difference. This is the same sort of scenery that we've seen already in the book. But the next two chapters, or chapters 21 and 24, move the argument forward. So let's look at them now. Because in chapter 21, the mechanical universe of the friends is refuted. Not just denied, but it's refuted. Up until then, Job has been saying, no, I haven't sinned. But now he comprehensively refutes what they have to say. So how does this speech follow on from Job's breakthrough in chapter 19, his speech in chapter 21? Well, up until then, Job was wrestling with the question, is God for me or is he against me? That's the great thing that was troubling Job's heart. Is God for me or is God against me? But in chapter 19, Job comes to some sort of resolution, some sort of victory. Remember our headings from last week. The true God is not the monster God. God the Redeemer will have the last word. The grave is not the end, but I'll see God. God will rescue me from himself. He's had this breakthrough. Job had been tormented by the question, what is God to me now? But Job has answered that. God is my Redeemer. Whatever else happens, whatever else I don't understand, God is my Redeemer. And so now Job can, as it were, turn his guns on the argument of his friends. Is it true, as they say, that the wicked always suffer? So Job says, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? Now, Job has already touched on this. He touched on it back in chapter 9. He touched on it in chapter 12 and verse 6. He said, in 12 and verse 6, he said, the tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure. But that was only in passing. It was a passing comment. It was just a thought that had come in and gone out. He was still absorbed with the question of his own relationship to God. But now he returns to their claim. They've painted this picture of a world where only good things happen to good people and where bad things always happen to bad people. And so Job paints another picture in chapter 21. And it's hardly a case of spot the difference, because the picture is totally different. Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Says Job in chapter 21 and verse 7. Why do they? Indeed, that really sums up the whole chapter. Why do the wicked reach old age and grow mighty in power? But the point is, they do. Verses 8 to 13, their offspring are established in their presence. Their houses are safe from fear. No rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail. Their children dance. They spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol, down to the grave. But this isn't a reward from God, because these are bad people. They say to God, depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Interesting, it's that cynicism that the accuser has. That's how the wicked act. Now, not that Job wants that sort of prosperity. We see in verse 16, behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? That's all that they've got, what they can hold. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Job's riches are the fact that he knows God. But the fact is, they prosper. He said, look at the world. So he continues, verse 17, how often is it that the lamp of the wicked is put out? Not often. And, adds Job, you can't explain it away by saying that God is just delaying and he'll punish their children. He sees what they're going to say. He says, you say God stores up their iniquity for their children. Let their own eyes see their destruction. For what do they care when the number of their months is cut off? The point is, he's saying, well, you're going to say back, well, but even if they prosper, then their kids are going to get it. You say, well, that's just an admission of failure of your view, he said. If a wicked man lives well and prospers, and then that's the end, that's the proof that it's not what you say it is. Now, Job isn't claiming that the wicked always prosper. It's not a sort of cynical mirror image of the friend's view. Rather, he's saying that sometimes they do. One dies in his full vigor. Another dies in bitterness of soul. They lie down alike in the dust. One dies rich and happy, another dies poor and bitter, and it's nothing to do with whether they've been righteous or wicked. Job has seen through the not too subtle comments. He knows that they're talking about him, but they're living in fantasy land, says Job. Zophar claims that the wicked man dies young, his pleasure is short-lived, and his death is drawn out, and it's utter tosh, says Job. What the comforters need to do is they need to talk to people who see what actually happens. So he says this in verse 29, have you not asked those who travel the roads? You know, people who are out and about, people who see how things are. The evil man is spared in the day of calamity. Who repays him for what he has done? When he is carried to the grave, watch is kept over his tomb. The clods of the valley are sweet to him. All mankind follow after him, and those who go before him are innumerable. No trouble, no accountability. And what a send-off he gets. It's a sort of wonderful funeral. They're all gathered up to say what a nice guy he was. And his grave is nicely tended in the cemetery. And next to his are some that are overgrown with weeds, but they were good people. That's what happens, Job says, often. Not always, but often. And if the wicked can prosper, then the righteous can suffer, which is what Job is claiming in his own case. The mechanical universe of the friends is refuted. Job basically says, look at how things are. It refutes your idea, this idea that you can tell that if bad things happen, you must be a bad person, and that only good things only happen to good people. It's just not true. Now, chapter 24 refines that picture. Job's doing much of the same. Eliphaz evades Job's point. The point that he makes when he speaks in chapter 22. So Job presses it home. You haven't answered. You haven't responded to this. And we're going to come to chapter 24 in a minute. But basically, wickedness is rampant. The poor are desperate. But God brings no one to justice. Wicked men just go on doing dark deeds. And the closing verses of chapter 24 are fiddly. I'm not going to go into the detail, but the general thrust of chapter 24 is clear, just like 21. Often the wicked are not cut off. So much for any idea of mechanical blessing on the upright. Yeah, Job ends the chapter. How then will you comfort me with empty nothings? There is nothing left of your answers but falsehood. You're not telling me to repent and I'll get it all back. There's no guarantee of that. Your view of the world as sort of automatic is just not true. It's just empty. How long will you comfort me? It's pretty blunt, but it's well deserved. Their view is utterly refuted. And this chapter should bury once and for all the idea that bad things always happen to bad people and good things always happen to good people. I mean, we don't need the Bible to teach us that. We just need our eyes open. We just need to be those who travel the roads and see. And yet this honest chapter 21 in the book of Job teaches us that. You know, many folks assume that this is what Christianity teaches. And they mentioned, said this before, but it's so common. I used to believe in God, but then this happened. I used to believe in God, but then my grand died. So the assumption behind that is that wouldn't happen if there was a God. Bad things wouldn't happen because she was a nice person. can't believe in God because of all the injustice in the world, as if Christians were saying, there is no injustice in the world because of God. I know God is watching out for me because these good things have happened to me. You say, well, you've got no time for God. The Bible is no way so naive. It says, open your eyes to the real world. Listen to Job. Listen to the travelers on the road. Listen to the news. Listen to what actually happens, says Job. In this life, at least, there is often no justice. Job is clear. It may not be pretty, but at least it's honest. Well, one final chapter to summarize. We've seen that the pounding continues, chapter 20. Zophar, the joy of the godless is but for a moment. We've seen the wavering continues, Job, chapter 23. Oh, that I might find him, but I'm terrified at his presence. Chapter 21, the mechanical universe of the friends is refuted. Why do the wicked reach old age and grow mighty in power? And one final chapter, one new thing. Chapter 24, the plight of the poor is highlighted. Plight of the poor is highlighted. We've seen in how in chapters 21 and 24, Job demolishes the simplistic worldview of his friends. But chapter 24 raises a point in its own right, the plight of the poor. And Job describes it very vividly. Some move landmarks. He's talking now about wicked people. Some move landmarks. You wake up in the morning and suddenly your garden's smaller by six feet because your neighbor's moved it. No, that doesn't happen. But the equivalent of it happens in our world. Some move landmarks, seize flocks and pasture them. The stuff that they've got, you know, the person driving by in the fast, nice car might have picked it. Or he might have it because he's been exploiting customers. You can't assume that. But it happens. Some move landmarks, seize flocks and pasture them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. You know, the hundreds of millions of robocalls that come out, which you answer on your phone, and they're telling you that you've had a tax refund, and you had one this week, I've had one this week, or emails. And who falls for those? People who can't afford to fall for those. Vulnerable people. And what happens if you fall for one of those? Then you get on someone's list. And there'll be more people because you're obviously a soft touch. That's our world, isn't it? They take the widow's ox for a pledge. They thrust the poor off the road. You're poor, you get a raw deal. That's so often the case around the world. So take healthcare in many countries. You're poor, you get the operation. You get the operation, you die. Verse 5 to 12 describes the lot of the poor. The poor go out to their toil. They glean the vineyard of the wicked man. The wicked man's the one who owns the property. The poor are just there doing the work for him. They go about naked, without clothing, hungry. They carry the sheaves. From out of the city, the dying groan. Yet God charges no one with wrong. This happens in our world. 21st century, just as much as in Job's day. The early verses in the chapter are rural, it's the countryside. Verse 12 is in the city, probably the following verses are in the city. And that closing verse, together with the previous, sums up the chapter. The poor are oppressed, yet God charges no one with wrong. How it is, how it seems, as we look out into our world. Verses 14, the murderer rises before its light, that he may kill the poor and needy. In the night he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer also waits for the twilight. They wrong the barren, childless woman and do no good to the widow. Murder, theft, men cheating on their wives, or wives on their husbands, people left as orphans and widows, things that people have saved up for years, stolen, families divided, kids without dads, a cycle of poverty, generation after generation. It's our world. And the poor suffer the most. Does it happen in our cities? It's a bleak picture, but it's just as honest as the rest of the book of Job. They wrong the barren, childless woman and do no good to the widow, yet God prolongs the life of the mighty by his power. He gives them security and they are supported. Job is genuinely concerned and bewildered. They live and die like everyone else. They're exalted a little while and then they're gone. They're brought low and gathered up like all others. He's saying, you know, some of them get away with it and then they die. Others are brought low. In the end, all the same. If it is not so, who will prove me a liar? The point is none of the comforters are able to prove none of them ever address what Job says here. In fact, they haven't got that much more to say after this, because he's completely skewered their view. It's unanswerable. Why is no one brought to justice? God charges no one with wrong. That's why the question opens the chapter. Why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty? Why doesn't he do that? Not that Job simply accepts it, because as we're going to find out, Job himself has spent so much time and energy seeking to improve the plight of the poor. We get this impression, don't we, from the early chapters that it's all just fun and, you know, it's just flocks and it's just family celebrations. But as we find out more about Job, we find that Job was tireless in his efforts for the poor. Job really did concern, giving aid, working for justice, caring. But he's not naive about what happens, and nor should we be. How should we apply chapter 24? Christians should care. Christians should care about the plight of the poor. It's not right for Christians to be unaware and unconcerned for the poor. Christians should care. Now, some of you are young people listening. Maybe you young people will grow up to use the minds and the skills that God has given you to help the lot of people who are less well off and to aspire for. That's what I want to do. I want to invest, whether I'm running a business or whether I'm involved in social work or whatever it might be, to help those who are needy. Not just handouts, but structural change, addressing real issues, justice. That's Christian. That's something Christians should aspire to, something that we should care about, that we should pray about. Not as an alternative to the gospel, not because we think we can fix the world, any more than having a job is an alternative to the gospel or a family is an alternative. It should just be one of those life aims under Christ. Christians should be at the forefront of intelligent social concern. Some of you might make a difference. All of us can care and pray and keep our eyes open. I rather suspect that Job's friends would say that the poor chose to be poor and that they deserve to be poor. But Job is keenly aware of the plight of the poor. It's what we see in this chapter. The plight of the poor is highlighted. Four chapters we've looked at today. I wonder if you've got your mind around those four chapters. Two things were more of the same. The pounding continues, the wavering continues, and two things took us forwards. Mechanical universe of the friends was refuted, and the plight of the poor was highlighted. But as we press on through these chapters of Job, as we press on, we can't help but asking the question, where is God and the gospel in these chapters? I wonder if you felt that. I don't remember. I keenly felt that when I was preparing this the first time I preached it. Where is God and the gospel? I want to preach God and the gospel in these chapters. Where is he? Where is it? That, of course, is Job's big question, isn't it? Where is God and the gospel? And we, like Job, will have to wait for the answer. But behind the scenes, God is holding on to Job. That's how Job is surviving the pounding. That's how he's hanging on. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, says Job in chapter 23. But in the gospel, there's an answer. We find God at Calvary, where Jesus died on the cross. Or maybe we should say, at Calvary, God finds us. In some way, Calvary, the place where Jesus died, is just as bleak as these chapters in Job. The pounding, the struggling, the injustice, just as bleak. The triumph of the wicked is utterly honest about the world and about how it is. But there at Calvary, Jesus carried the sins of his people, sins of the world, every way in which we're caught up, every way in which we're infected, everything wrong in our worlds, all that is twisted and broken in us, Jesus carried it, so that we might be forgiven. Job talked about being acquitted forever with his judge. That is the heart of the gospel. God is the judge who will acquit us forever, even though we aren't righteous. It's okay for Job, because Jesus has taken all the brokenness onto himself and the punishment. Jesus was tried and he came through as gold, as that gold which is his perfect character and the price of our ticket to heaven. Job asks, doesn't he, in chapter 24 and verse 1, why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty. But one day there will be a time of judgment where everything wrong will be exposed and punished. Only by faith can we escape that judgment. Is your faith in him? Is your faith, are you focused on him? Or do other things distract you and fill your mind? Is your trust in him this morning? Let's close. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we've continued on in our studies in this book of Job, seen so many things.